Hello, and welcome to recording number 35 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. Today is July 15th, 2021. We were just finishing here where Gord and Geller, and they've met Chert and Curly Greenleaf, are making their way through the woods to aid the King of Nyrond, Archibald, as the Ivid forces and Grenell are closing on in on him in a trap just outside the Adri Forest. It's page 263, the final paragraph. Gord was tired from the hard and fast trek, so he readily agreed. Both men slept soundly until morning, ate the meager ration allotted to them, and were once again striding along toward the gathering place at Oddgrave Hill. That day and the next were pretty much the same, and Gord grew used to the marching, so he was less irritable and more lively when dusk fell. Chert and Wren had resumed an easy bantering relationship the day after he had spurned her advances. Chert himself had broken the standoff by pinching the woman and making a suggestive comment. Soon she was as friendly and cheerful as before, and the barbarian giant was now almost pursuing rather than being pursued. Gord thought that perhaps Chert was both a bit shy with women and not very experienced with their ways, so that instead of being unresponsive to Wren's offer of favors, the fellow had simply not understood the intent. Well, it was too late now, for the next day they would be at the great gathering, and then off to Woodford, he supposed, to confront the advancing horde. Break. Something rather awkward, you know, the normal bit in the story is that both Gord's relationships with women are painfully awkward writing at times, and this business with Chert and Wren is to me again it's kind of juvenile fiction. I'm just sorry that Gygax, you know, that was part of his style. I don't know, it might just be me. These actually came out when I was about 18 or 20, and this first book. And, you know, I liked it pretty much thoroughly at that point. But since then, there's some parts that I find a little clunky, and definitely this last little bit here. There isn't really much, except it does show something of Gord and Chert's character. Just to re-mention that they're making their way off to Oddgrave Hill, which is a place I haven't seen, you know, put on maps and everything. All right. Yeah, you know, I think I'm not the only one who kind of feels this way about some sections of the writing. All right, I'm going to restart right here. It's page 264 and the third paragraph. By the time Gord and his companions arrived at Oddgrave Hill, several thousand of the free wood folk were gathered there, all armed and preparing for the battle. Stalker's warband became a part of a brigade numbering nearly 1,000. This force was to be a flank company with some special mission that would stay undisclosed until the whole army was in position. More groups came in on the same day that Stalker's did, and at the leader's council held that night, it was decided to wait no longer for any others who might be on their way. The army of woodsmen now totaled about 6,000 in all, and no more than a few hundred additional fighters could be expected. The time was at hand to march the 10 remaining leagues between them and the crossing of the Harp, so that the invading army sent by Overking Ivid of Eirdi would have to fight both river and woodsfolk in order to succeed. Break. It's the end of chapter 24. And this has some interesting information here. Stalker was leading a band of about 50 originally, and he may have gathered more in this final day that it took to get to Oddsgrave Hill. But still, he's immediately given charge of 1,000 1,000 of these woods folk. And that is, that's rather impressive. Then Stalker, even coming from a small community, must be a well-known, military leader or, known for his skills and such, because, to come with a band of 50 or so and be put in charge of 1,000, that is, that has made him one of the top commanders there. Because their whole fighting force is about 6,000 of these experienced woodsmen. But it was commented in the what we read yesterday that they would fare better as long-range fighters than as close, close hand-to-hand kind of fighters. Now, rangers and barbarians, well, rangers mostly, I thought, they weren't terrible fighters, and barbarians like Chert, who's supposed to be of the barbarian class, were excellent hand-to-hand fighters. So I'm not sure exactly what Gygax was thinking with that, whether most of them are, say, non-leveled woodsfolk who have a skill in bow or something, but just it seems odd that he'd figure they wouldn't be as good at hand-to-hand. And then we have that they're going to be crossing the Harp. So that does put the maps we've been looking at more into perspective. I actually thought that they were across the Harp and going to be heading for the Teaser Torrent.
They're still in the Adri.
Sorry?
I think they're still in the Adri, right? They're still in the forest.
Yes, but here they're saying that there's 10 leagues between where they are, and I'm reading that kind
that's
of
about the league is a weird measurement, but
league should be 3 miles, I think.
Yeah, that's what I've been using. I saw it anywhere from like 2.8 to 4.5, but I've just been saying 3 because it's
that's always here. That's always what I heard, that it was the 3 miles per league. So they're going to, they're 10 leagues. So,
that's about one Darlene square.
Oh, that's, that is about, one hex of the, Annemeyer map. Darlene, I believe it's 30 leagues per map. So it's almost, so it's roughly 90 to 100 miles per hex, on the Anna map. Not the Anna, the Darlene map.
Okay.
That's why things are so undetailed, is because there's every one of those hexes is so big. It's bigger than it's bigger than 10,000 square miles per hex. So
I know the Teaser Torrent comes in to the Harp at a confluence right under Nurl before it comes in the forest.
All right. My geography is not very good in this area. So, I really offhand, I can't really picture everything in my mind as far as the location of everything here.
Well, the only reason I can is because I've been going over it pretty much since we started this.
Yes, and those maps are very handy.
Great stuff.
So anyway, yes, that is true. That is just that they're going to be crossing the Harp, not necessarily where they're going to be fighting the Ivid's invading army. All right. And it does mention also that they put a parting here between river folk and woods folk. At the very end right there, because he's talking about that the Ivid king would have to, the Ivid's army would have to contend with both river and woods folk And, you know, I mean, that is a, you know, sizable amount right there of unknown troops that are supposed to be a kind of hitting Ivid's army by surprise. So no matter what size they are, that's, you know, going to take a bite out of them coming maybe behind them or flanking them.
Especially since they're like fighting in their homeland, and you always have an advantage when you're fighting on your home territory, especially with maybe somebody who might not be that familiar with forest.
Yeah, and these are going to be, you know, archers coming down on them, so they should be able to, you know, provide a good strike against whatever forces are there, especially because they wouldn't necessarily have to be attacking, you know, directly and forcing them to turn and come at them and fighting from behind. You know, with the archers could even be fighting from, you know, in the trees, from at the edge of the trees. They could be fighting behind, behind watercourses or, you know, some kind of walls or obstructions. So, you know, it's not just that, you know, that's a big number. And especially if they're going to be adding to it with the river folk, which we don't have any numbers for yet.
Yeah, a lot of the Harp flows through the Adri, so there's probably a significant number of river folk.
Yeah, and, you know, so we've got 6,000 here, plus a few hundred who may join with them for the woods folk, and then, which is very big if there's no sizable communities, because, you know, that the community they just came through was, you know, seemed to be like about 100 adults. And, you know, that's a pretty small community where they're going to gather up part of them and then add up to, 6,000 plus a few hundred more. And I don't think there are too many big towns to supply that many woods folk in the Adri.
Yeah, I didn't see any.
And this does, you know, this whole section here, it does flesh out for me a little bit what the Adri is like. You know, obviously these are scattered woods folk communities, so you're going to see them all through that central Adri. It is a huge, you know, if you look at the Arlene map, it is a huge wood. So, you know, there's room for you know, quite a few different things within it and different, you know, different monsters and tribes and such. But if there is an area there that has these scattered woods folk communities, there's it's not an unwild area, but it's not like an area where you're not going to find help or these little hamlets or thorps. And it does change my perspective on what the Adri Forest is.
Yeah, I always thought it was more elves.
Yes, and the only one so far is Curly Greenleaf, who's part elf.
Right.
All right, I'm going to restart right here. It is chapter 25, page 265, paragraph 1. The broad waters of the Harp River at Woodford were wide and rippling between tree-lined banks, save for a deeper channel near the western shore. Depth was nowhere above the knees, but the one deeper place, a stretch of perhaps 15 yards in width, the waters had managed to dig a place nearly waist-deep. Solid granite bedrock had resisted erosion. Beyond this, a man, animal, or even cart could ford the river here without difficulty or danger of drowning. A narrow road, one of only a very few indeed within the Adri Forest, led to the shallow place and away from the other side of the river. This set of pleasant circumstances had led to many groups using this ford, the latest of which was to be the army of Overking Ivid, which was advancing toward the river from the east. All right, so, you know, we see Woodford is still within the woods. I thought there was an area out just outside that was being gathered, but it still says that, you know, And, it's the tree-lined banks of the Harp River, and that right here, he is definitely a ford. I mean, it's an ankle-deep and at most a waist-deep place here where animals and people can cross, or even carts. So the river really does, for a wide river like that, it really is going to be a very, it also, would be a very narrow, very low river point right there where it's so crossed for such a broad river. That really does mean that that's got to be some kind of rise, maybe very gentle, but enough to, keep the area from flooding all the time. It would be interesting. One of the things is, I have a river by me. Or a stream, and what it has is during the spring when it rises, it's only about 2 inches, but it can get up as deep as the banks are about 10 feet right there. All right, and there we have Angleford or Angleford, and being shown on the Gray Fiction text, and Woodford being shown there as well.
I think Angleford might actually be Woodford, because the only road coming from the east is at Angleford.
Yeah.
I don't see that the Air of the Army is going to march all the way through the forest.
And it does say because
hundreds of miles out of their way to Woodford.
Yeah, and it specifically says it specifically says about the crossing here. Let me see real quick.
It's one of the few
narrow
roads.
Road, one of the only very few in the Adry Forest, led to the shallow place and away from the other side of the river. That could be the description of Woodford.
Mm-hmm.
But it just says that Ibid's army is going to be advancing. Yes, and it does seem more like that would be where Angleford is shown on this map rather than Woodford, which it only has a northerly road leading from Woodford. Well,
yeah, it goes south too, but
it is very it is very, the description is not that detailed here. So,
you know they're coming from Edgefield, though, which is at the edge, as the name would imply, of the Adry in the Great Kingdom.
So, you think that is to the south or to the east?
Edgefield is right to the east. It's almost directly here. I can post a better picture.
That's definitely more like Angleford or Angleford.
Because in Saga of the Old City, in Saga of Old City, it's Angleford.
Edgefield
and Angleford, and Woodford's in there too at the bottom.
And it makes no sense.
Why would they go south through the woods to Woodford?
It makes no sense that their Woodford would be, Angleford seems to match the description rather than Woodford.
That's fine.
Especially, it's a very large group. I'm going to restart right here. It is page 265, paragraph 2. The Overking's force was an impressive one. Ahead of the formations went a swarm of light troops, some afoot and some horsed, to scout and make certain that no men encountered could carry news of the armies coming to its enemies. These scouts were evil woodsmen, bandits, and the worst of the mercenary companies, and they were like a small army themselves, for they numbered well over 1,000, with a main body of light cavalry ready to charge into battle or carry news swiftly to the horde behind. Normally, these advanced troops were anywhere from half a mile to 2 miles ahead of the slow-moving army behind. The roadway allowed them to move faster than usual, however, and they were now easily 2 leagues in advance of their fellows. The advance group's commander, General Lomar, the Margrave of Uskedge, drove this swarm of murderers and looters far ahead today because he feared that there would be a hostile force barring the ford. Also, for this same reason, he had with him several companies of light mercenary infantry, plus a squadron of the Overking's personal armored lancers. With these reinforcements, he felt he could brush aside any resistance and hold the crossing until the bulk of the army came up. Break. All right. Yeah, you know, you're reading this. You know, you really got to think that it is, you know, that it's got to be a main road. Now, both of them are showing the same type of road, I believe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you look, it seems like it must be they're on their way to the place that is Ongleford, because of the talk of moving cavalry through these and a large force and moving quicker because they're on the roadway. I really think that what we have here is just a bit, you know, a bit off in where they're placing it. It's either this army's coming from the south or it's coming from the east, and it does seem more like it's coming from the east. I can see on that map there's supposedly a route through the upper edge of the Adri, and I wonder where that is mentioned.
Oh, there is.
And it would seem unlikely that they'd cut across, you know, that they would cut across there to then move north instead of, if they're at Edgefield, just move up through that northerly road if it actually existed. Well, in the...
Their objective is to come at Nurl from the west, right? They're going to come at Nurl from the west. The Jackal is going to come from the east. And then the humanoids and the Bone March are going to come down from the north. So they're doing a pincer attack. That's why they're coming like with stealth through the forest this way.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Yeah. At least that's how I've reasoned it out.
And I guess they're going to supposed to be traveling through you know, some kind of roadway that goes that is going to connect Woodsford, moving out west to the outskirts of the Adri there. Well, you know, it is
the that road north from Anglesford goes to, well, Fassle Farm, but it goes up to where they can get to Nurl.
Ah, okay. All right. Well, you know, a good deal of this is just that the actual directions in the book are not, you know, he's not giving things like this is coming from the east or coming from the south.
Yeah, and they said also yesterday that Angus Ford and the river, Flash Crossing were actually all the way up on the Tesser, too.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to restart right here. It is page number 266 and the second paragraph. General Lomar was pleased to find the place tranquil on the morning he arrived. Several hundred scouts had splashed through the cold water and combed the west bank, sending back word that no sign of an enemy could be found. Now his whole force was past the dangerous ford, while a courier group hastened back to give this happy intelligence to Grand Marshal Dreek. The Iridian general was just giving orders to send a small company of mercenary horse and foot farther ahead while the main body of the advance waited for word from the rear when a storm of arrows rained upon the troops. The broad-headed shafts bit through armor, killing men and horses as if a giant scythe had passed through the force. Even as the first shouts and screams were being voiced, a second volley of missiles struck, and then a third. general, being not a complete fool, understood immediately that a horseshoe-shaped ambush had been laid on this western side of the river, and his soldiers were caught between the offensive and the waters they had just forded. He turned and rode off immediately, his bright golden red banner bearing the arms of Uskedge, signaling the route of the retreat, even as his herald sounded the fact on his horn. The general made good his flight. No more than a few notes came from the herald's trumpet before a half dozen long arrows silenced its owner forever. Half of the advance force of the Eridan army escaped this ambush. These survivors were mostly mounted, of course, their horses enabling them to flee the onrush of men that followed the initial arrow storm. General Lomor was at the midstream on his way back across the river when the fullness of his disaster came upon him. More cloth yard shafts flew from the supposedly safe bank to the east. His accompanying clerics and the magic user near them began to prepare their spells, but exposed as they were in the middle of the river, none managed anything significant. The Margrave attempted to rally his remaining troops and make a stand where they were, while the spellbinders sheltered behind shields and men to work their desperately needed assistance. Suddenly, a cloud of biting and stinging insects buzzed around the trapped force. There was a confused scramble among men and mounts, all trying to escape the plague of pests, while still more arrows sped into the cluster of invaders with a sound similar to the hornets that were stinging them with less deadly effect. Break. All right. So, you know, here we have, you know, this trap that's been laid, and, you know, it's now taking its toll. And the comment I want to make is, you know, it's this is a force made up of, you know, not only the barbarians and perhaps rangers, but also the druids. And, you know, there we can see one of the rare examples of magic at this point. You know, the summon insect spell. And a wonderful...
I think it's summon insects, though.
You don't think it is, or you?
No,
think
I do. I do. There are a number. There's another one, a clerical spell, a fifth level spell, but I think it's this one because of the flying insects.
Yes, and so this is going to be a good way to lower, you know, in the game respect, it would, you know, lower spell casting, and it would distract. As well as a wound, the attack creature will sustain 2 hit points of damage per melee round, and can do nothing but attempt to fend off these insects during the time it is attacked. So all these magic users, well, whatever magic users he does have here in Ivid's army, those caught in this spell are going to be unable to cast any magic, and... you know, if he has any men with missile weapons, they won't be able to fire. And so we know at least that there's Curly Greenleaf, who is a 10th level, you know, he's a 10th level druid. And how many other, you know, druids are there? Because Curly said that, you know, the druids, who are, you know, the plural, that are within the Adri Forest are all coming to fight. And, you know, in the woodlands, my, that's, you know, there's so many things that they can throw up. They could, you know, throw things to block the block the roadway, and they can summon creatures. It's and this summon insects is particularly potent. Like, if this were Curly Greenleaf, this would be 10 rounds here, where the one spell... would be affecting them, and you know, they wouldn't be able to do anything. Even the regular troops would be, you know, like swatting around at the insects, taking 2 damage per melee round. So that's, you know, 20 hit point damage there after 10 rounds. That's going to wipe out most of the common soldiers who get caught in that. And you imagine, you know, wizards, if they're not something to protect themselves with their, you know, normally lower hit points, that is going to be a big, you know, all the lower level magic users would be killed.
And all the while they're fending off like arrows too.
And the other thing is, this was, you know, this was good tactics to catch them, you know, to catch them with in mid-river where they've crossed and now they've got to retreat back across. Now, it is shallow at this point, but still, it's not, there's no cover. You know, they're very much at the disadvantage here. And yes, you know, this is... you know, Gygax with his, you know, experience with miniature wargaming. And, you know, this was, there was mention, yes, in the material we read yesterday, where Gord was saying, you know, this going to war was a new experience for him. And, yeah, you know, that is true as the game went. With this, I believe this is before the mass battle rules came out. So unless you are playing chainmail, this is, you know, what we're going into is something you didn't normally run into in a AD&D campaign, was having your characters involved in general warfare into large battles. That was not a normal occurrence in AD&D campaigns, is that this aspect of a mercenary campaign or a general warfare campaign, that wasn't something that came up too much, you know, at least in my experience. Right. So, I'm going to restart. It's page 267, third paragraph. The sole surviving magic user, warlock calling himself Comet, managed to dispel the magically created insect swarm. Then the enemies from both sides of the river closed on the trapped remnants of the Iridian advance force. General Lomar threw down his sword and cried for quarter. No prisoners were being taken. His body fell into the water moments later, across that of his warlock, and the fight was over. Not one of the invaders remained alive, and none had succeeded in breaking through the ambush to get back and warn their fellows. An hour passed before the lead elements of the Iridian main battle, as the central division of the army was called, arrived at Woodford. The place was quiet, the waters were still, and no trace of fighting was apparent. A troop of light horse saw a strong body of mercenary infantry spread about on the opposite shore, evidently on guard against any possible foe, but obviously relaxed and awaiting the arrival of the Grand Marshal's army so they could push forward again to scout. Just visible on the road in the distance was the banner of General Lomar, the ensign surrounded by a small body of cavalry moving westward away from the river. Another small body of mounted men appeared from the trees along the east bank and waved to their fellows on the opposite side of the Harp River, signaling that all was well. The cavalry troop came across the ford first, keeping their horses at a slow but steady walk. The head of the marshal's long column of soldiers was marching swiftly toward the crossing place, and the horsemen wished to get clear of the ford before the soldiers arrived. There was no love lost between the cavalry, who were mercenaries, and the oncoming imperial and noble contingents. Break. So they're setting up for an ambush again. But here we have, you know, the trap is the trap's been reset, and the only thing that makes me wonder is the difficulty in dragging away the horses. You know, they did mention they were cutting down the horses as well as the soldiers, and you know, so there would have been a good number. Some probably survived, and they may be the ones that we're seeing here. as talking about the cavalry force coming out of the woods and on the bank of the river, and the other one pretending to be Lord Lomar and his guard. They may be surviving. Yes, and their standard, and it may be that those horses were brought by the woods folk, or more likely they're ones gathered up after the ambush. But dragging the horses away, covering up blood, it does speak to me that more there must be a classed barbarian and ranger. But of course the druids can also help with disguising things in the wilds. But
at a river too, so they could just put the bodies and let the river take them.
Well, they'd have to put the bodies further down. Remember, this is a very shallow ford, no bigger than ankle deep. At some places, they could probably get rid of a lot of the human bodies, but horses. Well, I guess they could cut the horses up and toss the pieces in the river. Also with transport, trying to move a dead horse is not something you're likely to do without people of extraordinary strength. So that they'd be pretty busy there dragging all these, because there's almost 1,000 men in this initial force, the scout force that was wiped out. All right.
I think it's good tactics, though, waiting, not barring their way to the river, but waiting until they get into it.
Yes, the roadway's very bad for them, because they'd be coming along, instead of in a protected, they'd be marching in column. So, to be able to, the width of the road, would probably, dictate the width of the column. But still, they're marching in a line where their flanks are very exposed to either sides on the woods. Now, when they're fording that river, it's the worst, even at ankle deep or waist deep, there's the worst footing. So they should be at a disadvantage there. And the fact that these, the archers are firing from partial cover from the woods, and these men may not even have much in the way of missile weapons, it certainly cut down their magic users. And then the horses aren't going to be very effective as a charge coming from the river. They'd have to get back onto firm footing to be able to, build up the speed. And, they're not going to be able to, it's going to be very dangerous trying to rush across the ford and make things even, a little more unsteady for the attack. We've also, we're learning poor Lomar is introduced and killed on practically the same page. It also, leaves me wondering now, they've lost 1,000 men already. The Ivid's Aridian army has lost already 1,000 men, and that was their scouting force. So this has to be a very large, large army. The only thing is that it does say that their cavalry, they don't seem to have a very large cavalry force, which is okay if they're fighting in the woods. But what they want to do is go up and ambush Archibald. So if their cavalry force is, decimated, it does put them at a big disadvantage later on. And it sounds like, again, the force that has moved up is the... has moved up is the cavalry from what they've said. Right. It is because the cavalry is rushing ahead of the infantry. And that was always, always a problem in real world combat, was when your cavalry forces wouldn't wait for the infantry to support them. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 268, second paragraph. The blue and gold tabards of the Overking's guard proclaimed the coming of the army. Although the noon sun was now being obscured by slowly thickening clouds, the crowned sun on each tabard's deep blue field seemed to glitter without the aid of beams from the real one above. The leading regiment was of archers, 1,000 strong, Short bow slung, short spear shouldered for the march. Behind them came a like regiment of crossbowmen, equipped with great arbalists and swords. Together, these two units composed the 1st Brigade of Heavy Foot, for they wore chainmail and stood in close formation. Behind them came the serried ranks of pole-armed infantry, imperial troops who bore glaive guisarmes and falchard forks. After a suitable interval came the disdainful and haughty riders of Ivid's own cavalry, light horsemen with small crossbows, bucklers, and javelins, then mounted sergeants in plate mail with lances, flails, and shields, and finally the so-called Knights of the Malachite Throne, in even heavier armor, bearing an array of heavy swords and axes, in addition to lance and shield. All of these horsemen held their slender javelins and long lances aloft, pennons astream, to proudly proclaim their presence. Although there were but 3,000 of them, they considered themselves to be the finest and best soldiers in the army. In truth, these cavalry were indeed terrible foes in battle, but in a place such as the Adre Forest, they were not of much use. They, and the pole-armed phalanxes as well, were much better suited for employment in the open terrain at Nurl and in the Blemu Hills. Break. Well, you know, we have a very nice, on the fiction chat here, a fiction text, we have a nice picture of the Ivid coat of arms there with the crown sun on the blue field. So here Gygax is showing you again his, you know, his knowledge of, through his wargaming of tactics and of like medieval tactics, medieval fantasy here, but and he, you know, as we were talking about in the forest, everyone in heavy armor and these more complex weaponry, you know, that especially pole arms of sort, they are going to be much less useful than people who can maneuver around in the rough terrain among the trees, because these soldiers are not going to be able to do formation fighting. So all the men armed with pole arms are going to be, you know, have a very difficult time outside of the ford area where it's just roadway and trees. They can form a defensive array, but that is mostly good against cavalry and other, you know, other hand-to-hand troopers. But against these longbow archers, it is, you know, fairly useless. And then we came up to Ivid's own, who bear only small crossbows, so that's short range, and they're in heavy armor. So they're mounted. They're not going to do well in heavy woods. If they dismount, their heavy armor is going to make them slow and cumbersome in the woods. It limits vision. So they're going to have a very hard time, even if they are escaping the ambush. If they have to, you know, they're not going to be able to retreat, because if they move down the road they came from, it's filled with other soldiers that want to advance. If they move forward, they're going to be moving into the arrows and then into the woods. So they're the horsemen are at a disadvantage. The only people who the groups that are in the very front, that are the archers, the shortbow archers and the crossbowmen, they will have a better time of it, but still, they're going to be stuck fighting from an exposed area in the ford, where I, you know, it sounds like they're not even going to reach the other side before the arrows start flying. Once they come to a stop, stopping the troops in column coming up, it's a very difficult thing. They're going to mash together, and the roadway for retreat is going to be blocked. And if they have to push off into the woods to either side of the road, that is going to you know, ruin their formation fighting. And most of these troops, now the men that were the evil woodsmen's and the bandits and the more skirmisher troops, all of their scouting force, 1,000 strong, they're dead and gone, you know, along with a handful of magic users and Lord Lomar. And so now we have another several thousand, I'm not quite sure. He mentions 3,000, and I'm not sure if that is the Ivid Overking's guard that is 3,000, or whether these combined brigades add up to 3,000. We're given a good idea here. I'd like the talk of what weapons they're using and the mix that they have. And they are at this point very unprepared for the fight because of the loss of their scouts.
Yeah, they're definitely not ready for a fight in the forest.
Yes. And that is you know, that's something unearthly. That's the earthly tactics that go back to the time of the Roman legions when they fought in the Teutoburg forest and 3 Roman legions were lost. It's not a good area for formation fighting. And that is exactly, you know, that's kind of like our American Revolution where, the British and the Hessians, and they were formation fighters. And they had a much harder time with the colonists because they were fighting very, very skirmish style, you know. And as they were generally on the defensive, they could, you know, dictate where the battles were set to their advantage. And here we have example of what that means, is that the woods folk have the advantage because they've chosen the best place for an ambush. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page number 268, final paragraph. At some little distance after the horsemen came a regiment of Volgiers, their long weapons surmounted by cleaver-like steel heads, and also proclaiming their imperial status by their bold colors. Thereafter came the train of artillerists, engineers, and sappers, who marched with the baggage and supply. A small company of mercenary light cavalry served as drab punctuation at the end of the Overking's main battle. A quarter of a mile farther back, the rear portion of this host was arrayed. This last division was a motley collection, composed of some 2,000 infantry belonging to the noble contingents levied at the Overking's behest. These footmen displayed a rainbow of colors and armorial devices, marking which lord they served. Weapons and armor likewise varied as widely, ranging from ransoor and halberd to axe and crossbow. There were relatively few infantry in this unit, compared to the total number of men in the force, because their noble masters deemed such troops to be fit, mainly for use as a buffer to absorb missiles, and even magical attacks prior to the charge of their more numerous mounted troops. Farther back, a host of pennants, banneroles, and oddly shaped standards marked the noble lords, knights, and esquires, who were riding before an even larger group of their mounted men-at-arms. As varied as the foregoing foot soldiers, this group of cavalry was as numerous as the imperial horsemen, although of questionable merit at times due to lack of discipline. For every baron, plar, count, or whatever felt himself a prince and peer to all the others. Nonetheless, once it was in motion, this mixed brigade was formidable in the extreme. At a respectful interval came the last elements of the army, a tail of mercenary light horse and skirmish infantry, totaling perhaps another 1,000, placed to absorb any sudden surprise from the rear. This vast force, strung out for miles, was about to receive a blow upon its head that the body and tail would be able to react to in Saurian fashion only. Break. All right. Now, you know, here we go, and quite an array of forces that is described here, and obviously, much more than the woods folk have gathered. I'm guessing probably 15,000 to 20,000 in this army. I might be wrong. I might be too low. I don't think that's too high a number. They had 1,000 men just for scouting. They have 1,000 men just as their tail. I think the main force, it sounds like, you know, there are over 3,000 cavalry in that first force, and then going back and going back and going back, I really think, you know, we're looking at it probably like 20,000. But like I said, that may be too low. So it's hard to tell exactly what kind of fighting, even with the advantages the woods folk have of the terrain, there's so many troops here that I doubt that that force can defeat this huge Erdi army, but they can. They've just decapitated it. They blinded it, really, by wiping out the scouting force. And if they wipe out the force at the end, they're going to have to choose, you know, kind of a replacement for who's going to actually be the rear. The most vulnerable are, of course, their baggage train and their specialist troops, who are going to be the, they're not there, the engineers, the sappers. They are not there to...
Is that what Volgears are?
Volgears, I'm assuming, I don't know the word, but they're armed with pole arms. So I just assume that they're a specialist force of pole-armed infantry. Okay. Because they're armed...
They have those cleaver weapons with cleaver-like steel heads.
Yes, and Volgears. They're the Volge. They're the Volgers. You know, a Volge is a pole arm. So that's what it is. I'm reading it like anybody with you know, like the general English way, that however you pronounce it is right. But yeah, that is a Volge, and I think there's
people who
like
use Volges.
Yeah, the Volge Guise arm, the Volge. Mm-hmm. It's just the type of head on the pole weapon, and rather than being a like an anti cavalry, I believe, I'm not sure, the Volge, you know, you can bring it down with such force because of the length of the pole arm, that it is a, you know, it's a very strong weapon right there. All right. So that Volgears, yeah, Vultures.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was. I was like, what is that?
Yeah, when I reread it, it's describing their weapon, then I'm thinking, what weapon? It's a Volge, so. And I probably didn't have the right pronunciation of it.
But now I can find it.
it's got it's the combination of
it's like a musketeer uses a musket.
Yes. And it's combination of axe and so it, you know, it strongly resembles a glaive. But I would assume that it's also an anti-cavalry weapon. Because you can, you know, use it as like a long spear point, but also right. You can do a chopping motion to strike at the legs of a horse. And you can also use it against heavily armored foes, because you see how long it is. If you bring that down with any force, because of the length of the pole, it's going to deliver a lot more force on the exterior end, you know, because you've got to, you know, moving the end of the pole in a short arc means that the top of the pole arm is moving down in a very long arc and at a greater speed. So, you know, that is going to be something very good to either crush or even penetrate heavier armor. But again, it's not a woods weapon. It's not something I'd like to, it would be, you know, in the woods, you could use it as a very long pole arm, as a pike kind of, but you're going to have a lot of difficulty trying to swing that thing around to use the chopping blade of it. It's also a very tiring weapon to use, because the heavier it is at the end, you know, it requires, you know, the more force you're going to have to require to wield it in that fashion. And even holding it up like you would a pike, to stab or a long spear, you're going to have quite, you know, it's going to be very tiring to be holding a weapon that's long. Normally, with a pike, you're bracing one end of it, you know, for most of the time is the you know, you're going to take the end of it and put it into the ground And, you know, a lot of times it's being used to hold off cavalry or used against other advancing infantry. So, all right.
Yeah, it wouldn't help you a lot against archers firing at range either.
Oh, it'd be useless. I mean, really, and most men who would be using pole arms would probably be lightly armored, you know, because they would not be set up so much. They wouldn't need like be in plate. They'd probably be in like some kind of leather armor or reinforced leather.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 269, and it is the second paragraph at the end. Foremost riders were well across the ford and amidst their supported counterparts before a sharp-eyed member of the mercenary troop alerted his fellows that the men around them were not friends. The resulting melee decimated the force and sent the survivors in rout, but served to alert the archers who were nearly across the river and the crossbowmen just behind, and thus the whole main battle soon knew what was happening. The Battle of Woodford now commenced. The longbowmen of the woodsfolk were ranged for 300 yards along the west bank of the river, hidden in the foliage and sheltered by logs and tree trunks. These archers opened a withering discharge upon their enemy counterparts, the devastation of which was only slightly lessened by the target's armor. Despite losses and disadvantage, the Imperial troops held firm, slowly spreading out their formation to present a broad front so they could not be as easily hit, and so as to be able to reply in kind to the hail of arrows, bolts, and sling bullets pouring upon their ranks. They were brave, these men, and half were slain or wounded by the time they were stretched the entire length of the shallows of the Harp, and were returning their own missiles in hopes of finding targets clad in colors that blended with the forest. The disciplined sacrifice of the archers was not in vain, for coming at the double was the narrow column of pole-armed infantry. When their bristling mass of glaives and falchards crossed the ford and struck into the lightly protected archers on the far shore, the sharp edges and points would pierce the woodsman's line and spread out along the river edge. Thus the onslaught of flying shafts would be assuaged, and the cruel tormentors plying their deadly bows would be slain. Although arrows rained in arching fire over the heads of the screening shortbowmen and crossbowmen to fall upon the rushing brigade of infantry, these latter men were more heavily armored, with studded jacks of padded leather over chainmail, and their front ranks were provided with steel chest plates and greaves as well. A few fell, but most came on unharmed. The screen of bowmen before them parted at their coming, glad at their comrades' ferocity and lusting for the slaughter that their arrival portended. Break. Well, you see, I you know, here I am wrong. The Imperial pole armsmen here are, Gygax does have them very heavily armored, chest plates, greaves, padded jackets over chainmail. So they are a very formidable force here in their defense. I'm not sure, you know, these are supposed to be the Imperial troops, so maybe they're more well-armored. And, of course, Gygax is choosing to emulate certain time periods in history. I don't know, I'm also not as much as knowledgeable, I think, as definitely as he was about, these pole arm forces. Even though they were in use for, you know, in various ages and for quite a long period of time.
He really loved the pole arms.
He did. I mean, in history, they were massively effective. And if you consider the Swiss used them, for centuries. And the Greek fighting was all this polearm fighting. And, you know, in different time periods, it was so massively effective because what it did is it removed a lot of the power of cavalry from, taking, wiping out the infantry. And if you knew how to fight in formation, and, you know, with these, I still don't see them being able to do exactly what Gygax is implying they can do, where the archers would have to break off. But even as skirmishers, once they step foot into the woods, once the archers are outside of, the length of that polearm, then your formation is shattered because you can't line your men up shoulder to shoulder.
In the trees.
And all they have to do is pull back in the trees. They're still going to get shots at these advancing soldiers. But instead of moving forward as a solid block, which is how polearm, troops were trained to do, they're suddenly skirmishers. They're suddenly, they're going to be a tree between them and their comrade. They're not part of the effectiveness of these polearms was they were amassed a serried array of these points, that were directed at the other foe, and that kept them from being flanked, and you have to go to the very end of the line to find the flank, and you curve it, and it makes it, and you can always square off the sides if you get flanked. So it is, of your formation. But once they're in the woods, and thick woods like this with the Adri, that's it. There's, rough ground and brambles and bushes underfoot. That's, once they're there, it would remove the archers from being able to get at the troops in the shallows, but and keep them maybe further away. But they still would be able to back off and start picking off these polearm troops. It might be enough delay for this large column to come up and keep reinforcing. But it really strikes me that. That is not quite how I see it. And I strongly suspect from the context here, it's not going to be what actually happens. All right. I am going to restart.
7:02.
Mike, it is.
Wow, this hour went. I can't believe it. I just looked at it and I was like, oh my gosh, it's 7:02.
All right. Well, I'm gonna end here then. That is a surprise. I thought it was no more than 6:30 or so.
Yeah, I thought we had a bunch of time left too.
Well, this is good a place as any. We're in the middle of the battle, but we're really at a turning point here where the archers are gonna have to change their tactics. So that is a good enough place to stop for the day and come back to it tomorrow. It is page number 270. I'm afraid I'm going to have to end it for today and call in Craig, our recording bot, to wrap up today's recording. I found this very, very interesting. This was a very exciting little bit here. I got caught up in it, lost track of time, and here we are, end of the day, but in the beginning of the big battle of Woodford right here. All right.